Brown. I'm Professor of History at Auckland University of Technology in Auckland, New Zealand.
Paul, thank you very much indeed for talking to the History Reclaimed podcast series today. We're looking at your new book on the shortlist. What's it called and when was it published?
It's called Colonising New Zealand, A Reappraisal, and it was published last year, 2021.
Where did you get the idea for the book Colonising New Zealand? I know that you've published previously about the history of New Zealand too.
It's a good question because I think most people would imagine that the topic has been researched extensively, and it has. Just about every aspect of New Zealand's colonisation has been subject to scrutiny by historians. But there are still some bigger issues at stake, trying to make sense of why colonisation took place in New Zealand, and extending from that, why British colonisation took place generally. And there's some partial answers, but I wanted to dig a bit further to see if there's an overarching answer to explain this great phenomenon, because really it's had a huge impact on the world, and particularly on the form of New Zealand, its society, its politics, its culture and so forth. So trying to get to grips with some of the reasons for this was the real motivation behind the book.
And can you just give me some key dates in New Zealand's history? For instance, I think over here we know James Cook discovered New Zealand in 1769. It's discovered the right word. And then subsequent dates which are important.
There's also a previous date I should add, which is about the 1100s, which is when the first Polynesians arrived in New Zealand. And they navigated over several thousand kilometres of ocean to sail to the country and populated it. And they were the originators of the indigenous Maori culture. Abel Tasman, the Dutch explorer, arrived in the country in 1642. He never set foot in New Zealand, but he mapped most of its west coast. He was working for the Dutch East India Company, and they decided that New Zealand really wasn't worth anything financially, so they promptly forgot about the place. The British learnt about the existence of New Zealand from the late 1640s, but didn't act on it until, as you say, Cook's expedition, which arrived in the country in late 1769. And Cook circumnavigated New Zealand, provided the first comprehensive map of the country, went back to Britain. He returned to the country, but Britain really didn't express much interest in New Zealand. And it's one of the enduring myths of the British Empire that British imperialists were like some sort of avaricious monster trying to consume as many colonies as possible. The truth isn't that at all. So Britain knew precisely about New Zealand from the 1760s. It took until 1839 until they finally agreed to have a treaty of cession with the indigenous population. And far from being a harsh, invasive act, the British Colonial Office said, "We recognise the sovereignty of the indigenous chiefs of New Zealand, and we want a treaty of cession only with," the phrase they used, "only with their free and intelligent consent." So it was very much colonisation by consent at that stage. After 1840, the embryonic British administration struggled for a good deal of time, but increased British arrivals in the country tipped the population balance in favour of settlers over the indigenous population. By the end of the 1850s, there was a majority white population in the country. By the end of the 19th century, 95% of the country's population was European and about 5% indigenous. That population change is altered again, but it just gives you an idea of the dramatic change the country endured during the 19th century.
I know, and you've written a book on the 1840 Treaty of Waitangi, and I believe New Zealand became self-governing in 1907. But in writing your book, Colonising New Zealand, have your ideas of British Empire changed over time?
I think it'd be fair to say that they've consolidated. My work up until this time really was to do with British involvement in New Zealand and how British policy emerged in the country in the beginning of the 19th century and subsequently evolved. Pulling the lens back to get a broader view of British colonisation, it's easy to see that there were faults along the way. There were some very terrible things done by the British or those acting in their name. But overall, I think my view has been consolidated that the British Empire was not this force for great evil that some people have since depicted it as.
And so what role did ideas about morality, is it right to use the word morality, Paul? What role did ideas about morality play?
It's right to use it in the sense that historians, or many historians, apply morality to their work. And some historians seem to soak up a great deal of their energy trying to assess the moral rights and wrongs of British imperialists. And it almost becomes something akin to an accounting exercise where they're adding up the inventories of good and bad and trying to determine was this particular action good, did this, was this more harmful, and so on. And then add up the totals and produce a judgment on the empire. And invariably nowadays the judgment seems to be quite negative, that the British Empire was a force for bad. It wasn't always seen that way, but that's certainly how it's presented nowadays. And that's inevitable. All historians write within the moral framework of the period that they're working. So we all bring our own contemporary moral perspective to events, but there are real risks in doing that, very serious risks. Each age has its own moral values, so we run the risk of assessing actions, say, in the 19th century by using 21st century morals, and there's a real problem methodologically in doing that. I think also that when you have a heavily moral interpretation of history, it almost acts like a form of cataracts, that you can't see things as clearly as you otherwise could. And so, to use Nietzsche's phrase, if you can go beyond good and evil, that opaque vision of history suddenly becomes a lot clearer. So there are problems with applying morals from one age to the actions of another age, and that's something that's been established for quite some time. The problem, that is. It still happens, but it's not desirable. But there are other issues to do with morality as well. One of them is what I call moral proximity, which is that roughly the closer an event is to the present time, the more likely historians are to judge that event in moral terms. And I've tested this very recently, looking at the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And I've been reading and listening to what historians have said about that invasion. And the language is quite instructive. They use terms like evil or grotesque or wicked or horrific, barbaric. These are quite strong moral terms. And you might think, well, fair enough. It is an evil and grotesque and wicked invasion. You might think that, and therefore those terms apply. However, the further back we go in history, and historians write, say, about the Norman invasion of England, almost 1,000 years ago, they tend not to use that language. The language they use is far more sober and restrained, and there's less of a moral dimension to it. Or if you read historians who have written about, say, the Persian Wars in the 400s BC, again, they're not likely to use that sort of emotive moral language compared with historians who write about perhaps the Balkans or Iraq in the 20th century and now Ukraine in the 21st century. So the further away we get from the present time, the less historians, as a general rule, tend to apply a moral measure to what happened. Does moralising matter? Well, I think it does. It leads to inconsistencies in the way it's applied to looking at history, but I think the bigger problem is this, and this is something that some historians overlook. If you view an event as being fundamentally a moral event, say an evil event, it's a very emotive term, but if you describe an event like colonisation as being evil, necessarily there has to be someone to blame for that. Well, to put it very simplistically, if there's a crime, there needs to be a perpetrator. So if you define something as evil, you have to therefore seek out who's responsible for the evil, and then you start to vilify that person. And we can see this happening in the whole statues debate around much of the Western world, that people who were once heroes now regarded as villains, because people are seeking out someone to blame for something bad that happened. And that can distort the way we understand history. If we start blaming people for things based on a current moral perspective, we can distort what actually people were thinking at the time and the motives of individuals. And so the moral dimension of history is hugely important, and I think it's something that In the area of colonisation, too many historians overlook. They're very quick to condemn and to judge and to bury the empire rather than looking at it perhaps a bit more impartially.
Thank you for explaining that so fully. I think, if I can just mention, in a previous book, you did court controversy by taking on the morality of the Maori culture and cannibalism. Is that right?
Well, I didn't court controversy. It sort of caught up with me, if I can rephrase that. What I did was to look at the fact of cannibalism taking place in New Zealand into the 19th century, it was being committed, and looking at comparative views of morality. Of course, the Victorians were horrified by cannibalism. It was something outrageous. At the same time, though, it has to be said for some of them, it was titillating. I think they enjoyed explicit descriptions. A lot of readers did enjoy these explicit descriptions of cannibalism. So on the one hand, they were repulsed by it, but they were equally intrigued by it. Maori culture had a very different view of cannibalism. And so that's a case in point where there's a risk of imposing one person, one group's morality on the actions of another. And I highlighted that throughout the book. It's a fairly unpalatable subject in every respect, but still it's one that highlights some of those moral problems.
So what are the main themes of your current book, Colonising New Zealand, and how did you go about addressing those themes?
Well, firstly, I wanted to look at how views about the empire have changed. And we know that in the Victorian period, the empire was seen really as a force of good. It was a way of protecting people, protecting what were called weaker races. It's about introducing ideas of justice and liberty and even democracy into the colonies. And the idea was that those things that made Britain great, justice, law, humanity, Christianity, could be replanted in some of the colonies. And so Britain was really doing its empire a favour. It wasn't an empire of extraction or exploitation, but one of good intentions. And that was very much the view in the 19th century, a popular view at least, among Britons. And towards the latter decades of the 19th century, there was almost this feeling that Britain had ascended to the state of imperial nirvana, that in a way sort of foreshadows Francis Fukuyama's work on the end of history. You can get a sense in the latter decades of the 19th century that Britain had achieved this wonderful empire, and people really felt, well, this is it. This is as far as we can go. It's the best of all possible worlds. We have a great empire, we have a great navy, we have great international prestige, and people feel privileged to be members of the empire. Those colonies actually relish the prospect. And you get that great metaphor that the sun will never set on the British Empire because it has this degree of permanence. But like the sun never setting, those ideas defy nature. The fact is, the sun does set, empires do eventually fall apart. They all do. And even in the late 19th century, the British Empire was already experiencing that sunset. I think the problem is that people at the time, in a sense, they were facing the other direction. They were looking at the glow of past imperial triumphs and not realising that things were actually deteriorating already. So the book addresses that theme of the way empires have been viewed and how popular opinion lags behind developments. That's one of the themes. But then it moves on from there and it examines this idea of looking at New Zealand's colonisation in a post-moral or non-moral way. So if you could strip away any moral judgments and just try to look at it as a process, what would that look like? What's the real nature of the British imperial system? And there are several answers to this already. Marxists will say that it was part of a process of global capitalist expansion, that the British Empire really was there to exploit other countries. It was the core. It entered into the periphery to extract wealth and impoverish people. And that's a fairly old argument. And people like Emmanuel Wallerstein have used that in the notion of a world system, that Europe was incrementally encroaching in the rest of the world to draw it into this world capitalist system. So there's that type of explanation of colonisation. There's the smaller part of it, but the patriotic part of it. There's a degree of national pride in having an empire, and that governs the way things work and why empires expand. There's the military explanation. When you have a very large navy to protect your trade routes, inevitably that brings you the power to protect further trade routes, and so trade expansion is possible, and the military grows in step with economic expansion. Then there's a humanitarian and / missionary role in the empire, that this empire of good intentions of spreading Christianity and British values throughout the world, that was an impulse as well. So these explanations already exist. The problem is, when you add them all together, you still don't get a complete picture. And some historians are quite content to say it's all about capitalist exploitation, or it's all about military engagement, or it's all about this, that, or the other, or it's a combination of them. But in all those explanations, when you look at them together, there's something missing. Still isn't 100% clear why the British Empire came into existence and why it spread the way it did in the manner that it did and why it ended. And none of the explanations given by a lot of historians anyway adequately address this. So by stripping away the moral view, at least you can start to investigate things a bit more clinically. And then you see that we're dealing with a system. The empire was a system, an imperial system, and again, various writers have dealt with this, but philosophically at least, one of the key features of systems, and this is crucial, is they can't bring themselves into existence. Something greater than the system has to create it, and Aristotle even mentioned this in a quasi-theological sense. So it has to be something outside the British Empire that brought it into existence, something bigger than the empire, and that's quite a confounding thought. What could it be? So before getting to that, one of the things I did was to re-look at the empire and cast it as an ecosystem. And if you consider a tropical jungle, for example, as an ecosystem, if a tree falls down in the jungle, that's bad for the tree. But it's wonderful for the saplings beneath, because now there's more sunlight shining through the canopy. Those saplings grow up and they eventually form part of the canopy themselves. So they take advantage of someone else's misfortune. And in doing that, the balance of that forest is restored. So the feature of this type of ecosystem is that it governs itself. It's almost like Adam Smith's invisible hand has a role in this, that each individual constituent part doing its own thing contributes to the functioning of the ecosystem overall. And in a forest, you don't need people giving instructions or agents carrying out certain functions. You just have every plant, every insect, every animal doing its own thing, and there's a balance that exists in that ecosystem. And I applied that model, a variation of it, to the British Empire, that really did act like an ecosystem. There wasn't a central intelligence guiding it, and that's what made it so effective, because it wasn't adhering to a particular policy or diktat from a particular leader. It was organic, it evolved, and it acted like an ecosystem. But going back to that point, there had to be something outside of it that brought it into existence. And so the book concludes by looking at what was that supra-system, the system outside the system that made the empire function, that made that ecosystem function.
And did you come to a conclusion?
I did, because that's in my character, that I like to reach conclusions. I don't like questions that aren't answered. And I don't think it's the absolute answer to this. I don't think it's beyond criticism, but I think it's worth exploring. And the conclusion is that this great thing is the need to achieve an equilibrium. And if you look at everything about British colonisation through that lens, suddenly things start to fit into place. If you look at New Zealand's colonisation, one of the things that's interesting is that the first Europeans settled in the country, permanent settlers, in 1814. But for a good 10 or 20 years before that, there were Maori from New Zealand living in the colony of New South Wales, British colony of New South Wales. So Maori had settled in a British colony before any Britons had settled in New Zealand. And that might be, you might interpret that as a quirk of history. But what it shows, if you look at it in detail, is that Maori had this particular reason for going to New South Wales, and it was to acquire technology, both military hardware and agricultural technology and know-how. And why? Because the British had it and they didn't. And they wanted to achieve an equilibrium. So the nature of the engagement was to achieve an equilibrium in this area. Look at the 1830s and 40s in New Zealand, where Maori literacy rates were higher than British settler literacy rates, which again seems remarkable for some people. But the reason for that is that a lot of Maori saw the benefit in literacy and they acquired it quickly, but also transmitted the rules of reading and writing to each other without European involvement in some cases. Why? To establish an equilibrium point with the settlers. And just about every active encounter between coloniser and colonised, at the core of it is this idea to achieve an equilibrium, and it might be in education, economy, religion, law, whatever else. And once you've roughly achieved that equilibrium, and it's not a fixed point, it can keep moving around, but once you've roughly achieved it, the impetus for colonisation diminishes. And this is why colonial periods come to an end, because one of the features of almost all colonial periods when they conclude is that in that colony there's some sort of equilibrium in terms of knowledge, economy and so forth with the colonising power. Doesn't mean that they're equal, that's different, but they've achieved the possibility of having the same levels of education, technology, economic growth, civil society, whatever else. And that desire to achieve an equilibrium, a balance between two groups that initially aren't in balance with each other, that's, if you like, the prime mover behind colonisation. The prime mover that it also explains the nature of British colonisation. It doesn't deny any of the impulses for it, commercial, humanitarian or others, but explains how it unfolds and explains why it concludes. And that is, in a sense, the suprasystem that explains that imperial ecosystem that I talked about.
And Paul, in that case, when people talk about pulling down statues, or perhaps they look at colonisation of other countries such as India, when critics say, well, you know, the British took and they didn't give, and then someone might reply, but look at administration, look at the legal systems, perhaps in New Zealand and India, and they owe a lot to the British. You can defend colonisation. It is defensible in this age.
Well, it's defensible depending on which measures you use. I know one historian's looked at life expectancy and pointed out that in several of the colonies that Britain intervened and acquired as part of its empire, the life expectancy of the populations in those areas increased dramatically over a short period of time. So you could argue that's beneficial. However, it has to be said that the British in some colonies broke their own rules. The British view that private property is sacrosanct was certainly broken in many countries, including New Zealand, where the government, if the indigenous population decided not to sell land, the Crown would simply say, we're going to take that land. And they so-called confiscated, effectively stole millions of acres of land. So there were transgressions as well. Of course, whether we say it's good or bad depends on our moral view. And in the 19th century, even those sorts of things, even the taking of indigenous land was seen as good, because they said in the long run, the critics said, this will be for the benefit of the country as a whole. Nowadays, I think we have a different moral metric, and I'm pretty sure in another 100, 150 years from now, our moral metric will be heavily criticised by historians. But if we remove all that, we could say, well, look, bad things happen, good things happen, we accept that. But this is part of almost like an evolutionary process. It's the way things evolve. We might not like it. I mean, some of us don't like the effects of gravity, but it's no use complaining about it, because that's a part of the natural order. You can't fight gravity. You may not like the effects of it, but it's there nonetheless. You might not like the fact that societies and countries and then empires evolve in the way they do, but if you try to argue too forcefully against it, it's almost like arguing against evolution. Just because you don't like it doesn't mean that it doesn't happen, doesn't mean that it's unavoidable. It's just the nature of things.
Well, can I now have a little bit of fun with you? Just three very quick-fire questions, which perhaps you can give short answers to, Paul. Did you meet your deadline with Routledge? Did you get the book over the line in time?
Absolutely, yes. I've written a number of books. I've never had a book run over time. I'm very fastidious about that.
What about writer's block? I know you're an academic, but did you just think, you know, I can't get to the end of this chapter, it's not going in the right direction?
No, I probably suffer more from writer's incontinence. I'm quite disciplined about this. I make sure I set time aside each day and I make sure that I get through certain challenges or certain readings each day. And over time, that discipline, I think, pays off.
And what about a eureka moment? Did you wake up in the night and think, you know, I really hadn't grappled with that problem before. And, you know, this really is new. Your discoveries.
That happens quite a lot. And I find myself waking up and thinking, oh, what about this? And then there's a whole lot of extra reading I have to do for that. And then that leads on to something else. So part of the discipline, of course, is sticking to the main purpose while at the same time not shunning alternative views. I think it's a risk that some people fall for, this temptation of having a view and then only really gathering the information that supports it, having a few contrary bits here and there to give the impression of impartiality, but by and large saying, well, look, I think this, I'm going to gather the information that supports my view. And that's, in a way, more the work of a propagandist than a historian. And although it annoys me enormously because I wake up frequently at night thinking about this, that, and the other, and I should have done this, or what about this, and you know, you read very broadly and other ideas come into play, I'd much rather do that than have a comfortable night's sleep thinking that I've got this right. I think that would make me anxious.
And how long did it take to write, beginning to end?
It's a difficult question because I was working on other projects, but probably 4 years, I think, all up.
Well, I should say congratulations on becoming a shortlister for the History Reclaimed Book Prize. Thank you very much, Professor Paul Moon, for speaking to the History Reclaimed podcast series today. And should I say, a new door opens as one closes. I presume you have an idea of what you're going to work on next.
Yes, I've got quite a few. It's just that I don't have enough years left to do them all, so I'm going to have to start culling some of them. But thank you very much.
Thank you. I've very much enjoyed talking to you, and good luck.